Good morning, Justices.
Hold up. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I may please the court. My name is Yvonne Shule, and I represent Terrence Kevin Hall, Lynchburg Circuit case, and as his court appointed attorney, Your Honor. I may reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Did you say two?
Three.
Three, all right.
Thank you, sir. Judge, the sole issue here is whether the Court of Appeals erred when it determined that the Circuit Court did not err when it denied the motion to set aside the mandatory sentences for Mr. Hall as untimely. The so-called escape clause in this code, section 18.2248, actually has two components. One is, of course, the timing, and the other is the accuracy. It's important to note that Judge Yates in the Circuit Court did not address the accuracy because he did not read the note that was attached to the motion. He simply denied the motion as untimely because it was filed minutes before the sentencing hearing started.
May I ask you about that? Suppose the judge had said this. Suppose the judge had said, look, you guys dropped the stuff on me, you know, at the very beginning of this hearing. I've read it. You have the burden of proof. You know, if you're going to convince me and you have the burden of proof, I need more than you giving me four sentences on a piece of paper. Is that all you got? Yes, sir, that's all I got. Okay, denied. So I know that's not your case. I'm not trying to apply it is your case, but wouldn't that be perfectly appropriate, even though the reason why it's so cursory and so unpersuasive and so insufficient to satisfy the burden of proof is because it was dropped on the judge with nothing else but these declaratory, conclusory, self-interested statements by guys trying to get out of jail, which is a pretty good motive for wanting to exaggerate stuff.
Yes, Justice Kelsey. And in fact, in this case, we're asking for the case to be remanded to court for a new sentencing hearing. And I'll admit that there's a very good chance that the judge at that stage may actually decide, well, this is not enough, it's not truthful, I'm denying the motion for that reason. Mr. Hall never had that opportunity. It was simply denied because it was untimely. Now, the code clearly says not later than the sentencing hearing, and our argument is that there's nothing vague about that language. It says not later than.
So, again, so I can tease this out. So if, in theory, the trial court had said this, okay, what's the next thing on the docket? Commonwealth versus Hall, I got something to hand up. You hand up. Your burden of proof is not satisfied. Move on. Let's talk about the PSR. Would that have been, under your interpretation of your argument, a problem?
Well, yes, Justice, it would be, because in that case, I don't believe the judge would have taken the time to make an accurate determination that this was, in fact, that there was, in fact, not enough there.
Why couldn't the judge just say, I just don't believe defendants who say, sorry, and I really didn't do anything wrong, and I need evidence. And if you don't have evidence of your assertions on a four-sentence pleading, then I'm just not going to grant the safety valve.
Well, Judge, I don't believe the judge has that discretion. The judge needs to weigh what is being proffered. And if the Commonwealth...
Proffered? So he's got to accept a criminal defendant's proffer when the defendant's trying to say, I don't want to go to jail?
Well, no, he doesn't have to just accept that, but there should certainly be an opportunity to explore that.
Right. I'm not implying it otherwise. If he shuts off the defense, of course. But I can sympathize with this trial judge and trial judges like this if the assertion being made by the defense bar is we can walk in, throw something at you at the beginning of trial and expect you got to take this at face value or you're cutting us off too early. And I can hear the trial judge is saying, well, first off, I'm not cutting you off at all. I'm just unimpressed with this effort, this incredibly marginal effort to meet your burden of proof.
Well, Your Honor, there are certainly numerous reasons why a defendant might choose to make this offer late in the game, which, of course, in this case, he did. I mean, he could have been ill. He could have mailed it to an attorney and it hadn't arrived on time. There are a variety of reasons.
Including the fact that he doesn't want the Commonwealth to find out that everything he said is false.
Well, and that would be something that should be explored. And the argument from the Attorney General that the court should just swallow everything at face value is certainly not what we're arguing.
Okay, that's
there
what
are other avenues.
To get.
There
right.
could be a continuance. The judge could take testimony during the sentencing hearing. And there's no harm whatsoever to the Commonwealth to do that. The defendant's already in jail.
Okay, can I? This is my last question on this subject.
Yes, sir.
So I'm not misinterpreting what you're saying. If I'm the trial judge and you give it to me 10 seconds before the hearing starts, and that's technically not procedurally defaulted because it's too late, and you hand it to me, and that's it, mm-hmm. would it be wrong for me as a trial judge to say, well, I see what you say, the burden of proof's on you, is this all you got? Yes, sir. Well, deny. Why? Because I need evidence. I need something. Just you telling me is not going to make me believe you. You're a criminal defendant trying to get out of your sentence. And the fact that the Commonwealth hadn't had any opportunity to bring me any evidence means I'm not willing to take a risk. Is there anything about that reasoning that you would say, no, actually, you're wrong on that?
Well, Justice, but that didn't happen.
I agree.
Yes.
Is there anything about that your theory of the case would include? Is there anything about that scenario that your theory of this argument would exclude?
Judge, given the fact that there is no harm to the Commonwealth whatsoever...
So he gets an automatic right of continuance. That can't be the right answer. You walk in, you drop in, you say, well, if you don't agree with me, I get a continuance.
Well, you're saying he could take the stand, and he could be cross-examined.
He could be. Yes, Justice.
Right then and there. And then the court could say, okay, well, under these circumstances, I need a continuance. I mean, the Commonwealth may say, well, this is really good stuff, and we want to explore this further. We want a continuance, because he's now finally, belatedly, coming clean.
Well, Justice, yes, and theoretically, hypothetically, suppose the defendant had written a note, and again, I want to emphasize, the judge did not read the note, had written a note with 20 names and addresses and phone numbers and contact. If we follow the logic, well, you're too late now, I would think in a case like that, certainly a court would say, well, you did it 10 seconds ago, but I still want to hear it. I want to continue it. I want to explore it. And the Commonwealth may very well do that, too.
The question is, does a trial judge have to do it? Sorry.
I would say yes, Judge, yes.
I was going to say, do you think it's relevant in this particular instance that the Commonwealth had looked at it and said, this stuff is of no use? This is, you know, Judge, we don't recommend that you ignore the mandatory minimums in this instance. Because, you know, what he's given us, we can't verify it. What about the Commonwealth telling the court right before the court makes his statements in this particular instance that they don't think very much of what they've been handed concerning the
Well, Mr. Fenley from the Commonwealth actually did make comments like that. Our argument would be that that is not based on anything that he explored or... I mean, just to say, well, any defendant is lying, therefore we're not going to believe anything that they write or...
Can I ask you a question, counsel? I'm sorry to interrupt you. It seems like you're implicitly or maybe explicitly saying that the judge has got to make a determination about the truthfulness of this information. Is that correct?
Yes, he does. Yes,
well, then, let's be practical for a minute. Whenever you want a judge to make a determination, don't you give the other side notice of what your motion is going to be in sufficient time for them to agree with it or oppose it? Isn't that the way that it should work? And then you would both come into court and you'd have your arguments, and that didn't happen this time.
Certainly, Justice Powell. That in
Actually, I'm not Justice Powell, but...
I'm sorry.
We look alike, but I'm different.
Sorry. Okay.
We confuse them all the time.
That's okay. I'm sitting in her seat.
I was trying to be good. I would certainly agree that in the ideal world, in the perfect world, that would be the case, but that's not how the statute is written. And to add more meaning to the words not later than,
I don't know, that's
does
what
harm to the defendant, and it does harm to nobody else.
How about the last couple words of that part, E part, which talks about the judge making a determination? So I think it's right in the statute. The judge has to make a determination if there's a disagreement about whether it's been truthful and whether it's been provided.
Absolutely, Justice, but it doesn't say,
when
it has to happen before
the hearing.
You think
it's a badly written statute and we're stuck with it?
It has to be by written motion, or the Commonwealth has to agree that everything has been complied with.
Okay.
Did you look at any persuasive federal precedent on this point?
Judge, the Attorney General did mention one case in its brief, and I believe that was in the Sandage case, which is the only case on point here.
Because I found a whole bunch of federal cases that are quite on point.
Well, I've really only read Galvin-Manzo, the case that was mentioned by the Attorney General.
Okay.
And that case can certainly be distinguished because in that case the defendant had already twice provided information that turned out to be not truthful. So in that case, the judge actually weighed his truthfulness as having already been untruthful. In this case, we don't have anything. We don't know whether Mr. Hall was simply lying when he said, I only know new nicknames and phone numbers. That was his statement that he claims is his truthful statement. There's been no... We cannot compare the two because the truthfulness in the Hall case, my case, was not at issue. It was only the timing.
But the trial judge doesn't have to decide he's telling the truth versus he's a liar. The trial judge can simply decide he has the burden of proof and he hasn't established what happened. So, I mean, it seems to me, this is what I think, at least I'm going around and around with you, it seems like you win the battle and totally lose the war, because you win the battle for any trial judge that says, oh, wait a minute, when did you actually turn the paper over to the prosecutor? 5 milliseconds prior to the hearing. Okay. Well, is this all you got? Yes, sir. Okay, denied. Why? And you're not considering it. No, I am considering it. I'm just not willing to release this defendant from a mandatory minimum statutory punishment based on unverified, untested, self-interested statements of a defendant trying to reduce a sentence. And if you don't put on evidence, why wouldn't that be a perfectly reasonable response for any experienced trial judge to do?
Well, Justice Kelsey, let's suppose that this motion had been filed 2 weeks prior, handed to the Commonwealth's attorney. Commonwealth's attorney reads the notes, says, well, this is garbage, I'm not even considering it. Then we would actually be at the same situation in court.
All right, and I think
Commonwealth's attorney would make
the same
argument. And then, I'm sorry, Justice, I interrupt you. Then the judge could actually make a determination and say, well, I've now considered this on the merits, and I'm denying the motion. That didn't happen here.
Counsel, this unfortunately is a poorly written statute, and it doesn't reflect any real understanding of how courts operate. And that's a problem. But having said that, I'm trying to figure out exactly what is before us here. Surely the judge has the authority to reject the proffer of what your client gave, but my understanding is that that's not why it was denied. Hypothetically, all of these things probably are correct, but am I correct that the only reason for denying the relief that your client requested was because it was he failed to comply with the provisions of Code Section 18.2-248C, and that failure was because he provided his statement on the morning of the sentencing hearing. And then the trial judge said, consequently, it's not within the prerogative, meaning I don't have the power, to deviate from the mandatory minimum set forth. Is that correct? Is that the ruling?
He denied the motion as not timely.
So we have a statute, which I concede is poorly written and does not comply with anybody's real-time understanding of what actually happens in the courtrooms of the Commonwealth. And all that says is that... not later than the time of the sentencing hearing, the person has done such and such and so and so. Well, his decision was based only on the first adverb clause. That somehow he didn't comply with that. Is that your understanding of the case?
It is, Judge. Justice.
All right. Would you like to reserve the rest of your time?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am John Jones on behalf of the Commonwealth, and we are asking the court to affirm the sentence imposed by the Lynchburg Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals decision affirming that. I think that it's important to just start out by saying that in the Sandage case, the issue was whether, you know, statements provided after the beginning of a sentencing hearing could be considered timely. And the Sandage Court said, no, they are per se untimely if there's an attempt to provide afterward. Just because a statement provided after the beginning of a sentencing hearing is per se untimely, however, that doesn't mean that that one provided just before the time of the sentencing hearing is per se timely. And I think that's the essential question. Let me ask you this.
Am I correct this is based on a federal statute or appears to be?
It appears to be.
I mean, it seems to be word for word.
It seems to be, yes.
And here's what I found. I found a number of U.S. Court of Appeals cases addressing this very dilemma. And they say, I thought it was uniform, and maybe I missed one, but that you can't disqualify someone at the threshold in the words of the Second Circuit. I mean, statute says exactly the timing, and I agree with the Chief. It's not real-world practicality, but it says what it says. So then they remand, because this recurs with these defendants, try at the 11th hour to, you know, make some disclosure. But they point out the fact that appellant repeatedly lied and obstructed justice prior to allegedly telling the complete truth will be useful in evaluating whether appellant's final proffers were complete and truthful. So in other words, the timing issue is just plain language of the statute. And yes, you can do this, however impractical it is. But then the judge, looking at this, although it has to accept it, can say, no way. You know, this kind of cursory, you know, I don't know nothing about nothing, is not going to persuade me, and you don't get your break in a sentence. Are they wrong in that approach?
I don't think that they're wrong, but I think the persuasive value is impaired by the fact that the federal system has a much more fulsome debriefing process that is at least partially judicially overseen. And we do not have any similar mechanism.
But isn't that the risk the General Assembly took when they, you know, cut and pasted a federal statute and dumped it in the Virginia Code?
I can certainly appreciate that. However, I don't think that just because the language is the same that Virginia needs to take the same approach to this particular issue that the federal courts have. And you know, even
it
if...
Just, it doesn't seem like it's a huge burden on either trial courts or the Commonwealth to say, well, yeah, you can do this, but then we're going to view it with a jaundiced eye precisely because of this timing, and then we can look at the nature of what you're tendering, and then using common sense, as trial judges are great at doing, say, no way, or, well, you know, Johnny come lately, better late than never, and you get your break in the sentence.
I think that that would have been within the court's discretion to do that, but I don't think that the court was required to on these facts. And
I mean, have you found any federal appellate case saying the language doesn't mean what it says on that side?
No, Your Honor, I have not.
But your point is, well, look, Virginia just applies this differently, and Virginia is different.
Yes, Your Honor, that's my first point. And my second point is, just because, even if the statute doesn't make it untimely within the language of statute, which I think I would concede, that doesn't mean that it's timely within just the fact-finding mission of the court and the adversarial system as we implement it here in Virginia. And the timing of this particular statement, and I think the court went over this in announcing its decision, said that, you know, the court has to determine whether or not there's been compliance. And I think, Justice Millett, you made this point that the last words in subsection E says it's conditioned on the court finding that the subsections have been complied with.
Can I stop you there for a second? Because my understanding of the problematic nature of this case for you is that it sounds like the judge didn't consider it. He said, I'm not going to consider it at all. I'm not even going to look at it. And that seems to be at odds with the language of the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that the statute says that if you try to provide it after the beginning of a sentencing hearing, it is per se untimely. But the judge has to be able to look at this statement with some input from the adversarial system and some ability to rationally determine it just on basic principles of the judge's inherent role and authority in making
decisions. He didn't explore that, though, did he, counsel? I've tried to look through real closely what he said, and he just didn't ever explore that at all. I think you've got a good point, and that's the point I was trying to make, too. Mm-hmm. But he just basically said, we've been having this kind of problem lately. I'm going to nip it in the bud. You're too late. And is that in violation of the statutes, in derogation of the statute?
I don't think that it's in derogation of the statute because I think the court could rely on its deeper function as whether to consider evidence as admissible and as truthful. And I think that, you know, there was a suggestion that in a perfect world that both parties would be aware of the substance of a motion before the time of the hearing for the motion and of relevant evidence, and especially in this context. It's not just in a perfect world that that would be done. That's one of the basic principles of fairness. You have to at least apprise the other party of the nature of what your motion is going to be and what you intend to offer in evidence, and that wasn't done here. And Mr. Hall is seeking a benefit on the basis that he has complied with the statute, but he deprived the Commonwealth of the ability to test whether that statute was true or complete. And he deprived the court, thereby, of the benefits of the adversary.
But is that really the case, though? Because this is a very succinct thing. I mean, in other words, he doesn't go through page after page, well, this happened on this date with this person. He just says, look, I just don't know anything. I was a drug dealer, but I don't know anything about anything. I didn't know who my suppliers were. It was all done anonymously. So you put him on the stand, and you say, well, hang on, and then just impeach him, and then the judge says, yeah, I don't buy this at all. So is it, maybe in a different fact pattern, but on this fact pattern, was the Commonwealth really inhibited from the ability to explore? I mean, he's there at the sentencing hearing.
And certainly, Your Honor, I would agree that the Commonwealth could have done that and the court could have done that, but the question before this court is whether it had to. And I don't think the answer to that is yes. I think that perhaps it was timely under the per se timeliness rule in the statute, but the broader principles of the court's authority and the court's discretion in hearing evidence and in sentencing matters, it could say, no, you haven't given your opponent the opportunity to even form an opinion on that. And so I'm not going to consider it. It's untimely under that basis. And
but that's writing in a lot of words to the statute. The statute is clear, not later than the time of the sentencing hearing. And even Sandage, I mean, this is the Court of Appeals says a defendant must provide the information not just prior to the commencement of the sentencing hearing, which is not even in the statute. I mean, that's a higher burden than what the statute says. But far enough in advance of that hearing to permit the Commonwealth to test the statement for veracity and completeness, I mean, none of that is in the statute. So how can Sandage even be right?
Well, Your Honor, I just would go back to this is not a function of the statute that I'm arguing. It's just more a function of the court's role and the court's authority in hearing evidence generally. And if the proponent of evidence and the proponent of a motion comes into court on any kind of motion.
Right, but as Justice Millett said, in this case, the judge didn't even consider it.
And again, Your Honor, I would rely on the fact that the court would have within its discretion the ability to say you haven't apprised your opponent of the nature of this motion. It's the sort of motion they'd need to know about beforehand.
Well, I mean, I've had cases where, you know, for example, with Brady, the Commonwealth on, you know, the morning of trial says, well, here's the defendant's criminal record or whatever. And then the law is as long as you disclose, now maybe it's not sporting or whatever, but as long as you disclose it in time and satisfy your Brady obligation for the defense to make use of it, well, then that's fine. There's no constitutional problem. But that's a highly contextual, you know, some things you defense that's not going to work. They need to look into it. Well, with what we have in front of us, was it really, to draw my Brady analogy, did it foreclose the Commonwealth from making use of it at the sentencing?
I don't think that it did, Your Honor. I think that the Commonwealth could have done that. And again, I would just respond that the question here is whether the Commonwealth or whether the court had to do that.
Understood.
I don't think that it did.
You mentioned this, a federal debriefing process.
Yes.
Can you just sketch that out for us and how that's different from what happens in state court?
I don't have an in-depth knowledge of this, but if you read...
It's more than what I've got, so you can help me out.
If you read through the federal case from the Tenth Circuit, United States versus Galvan-Manso, there are some references to judicially supervised proceedings and earlier hearings where the Commonwealth, or where, not the Commonwealth, but the government had complained that he either had not been completely truthful, and there were determinations that he had not been completely truthful.
Because I know oftentimes the defense will approach, you know, whoever, DEA, FBI, whatever, and say, well, for mitigation of sentence or even pretrial or whatever, and different things can go on at that stage where they're defiant or more or less complying or whatever. I wasn't sure if that was what was going on or if there's some other proceeding, but that's okay. Yeah, I don't want to take up all your time on that.
And if the court was interested in that, I would be happy to submit
that's quite
additional briefing. But, you know, I think it's important to get back to the purpose of the statute is to incentivize truthful and complete cooperation with law enforcement by providing recidivist drug dealer defendants an opportunity to help the police go after the higher targets in the chain. But the federal courts have said that their version of the statute is there to reward defendants who completely cooperate. And whatever complete cooperation means, I don't think that, and I guess this does kind of go around the central point about the timing of it, the timeliness, but I do think that the timing of the motion being provided is important to being able to assess whether someone has fully complied with the
meaning. May I ask you this? Tell me what you think is wrong with this synthesis. A trial judge under this statute cannot refuse to consider one of these requests as untimely and thus invoked like a statute of limitations or a time bar, a procedural default bar, if the request is made any time, even a second before the hearing. Once in the hearing, it's obviously too late. But if it's made a second before the hearing, though the trial judge must consider it, the trial judge may also consider the fact that it's untested, uncorroborated, self-interested, and worth nothing, and blow it off in a matter of seconds if there's no effort at presenting evidence because it's so speculative and so obviously beneath the burden of proof. Is there anything about that synthesis you would disagree with?
The only reservation I would have with it, Your Honor, is that language is not in the statute. There is not a requirement that the trial court consider it in a way that it would not have the discretion of whether or not to consider another sort of motion.
Well, I think you're hearing from almost every justice of the court that the literal language of the statute precludes a procedural default argument based upon timing, but it doesn't preclude a substantive, deliberative decision that turns on the fact that no one has tested this, no one has corroborated it, and there's no evidence other than a self-interested proffer. So, I mean, your timing-like points substantively I don't think are in contest, really, even with your opponent.
Mm-hmm. I think it's difficult to foresee under different facts how that might play out, and so I hesitate to concede that would be a good thing to tether the trial court to, that you must make a merits determination on a given, obviously on facts like this.
But it's so easy to do. I look at this, you have the burden of proof, I'm not persuaded, move on.
And Your Honor, I mean, given that the default rule is that the mandatory minimums apply and that has been sort of the paradigm that the General Assembly has established as being the norm, I don't see a huge policy problem or a problem in function with your synthesis of that. I just, it is the Commonwealth's position that no such requirement does exist in the statute, and so I would not impose one.
I mean, essentially, we read the plain language of the statute in light of the sort of common sense notion that trial courts can police behavior that's detrimental to the truth-finding process, like 11th-hour motions. For instance, a motion to rehear on the 21st day, and the court just says, look, that's just too late. Or, I mean, something of that nature.
Yes, Your Honor. One point that I would make is that if there was one of these motions and it did contain potentially helpful information, we're not dealing with the I don't know nothing sort of thing, but somebody does try to roll over on their supplier or something along those lines, and there's not been an opportunity to vet it, I think that it's important that burden of who needs to be moving for a continuance to be able to vet it. That needs to be clarified. I think under traditional principles that it would be the proponent of the information, but that's been disputed in briefings. I would just renew my request that the court would affirm.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
I believe everybody in this courtroom agrees that the statute that we're discussing is, that particular clause is not exactly artfully written. Justices, the statute clearly says not later than. That has plain meaning, and not sticking with the plain meaning of that particular language does not lead to anything which has been described as manifest absurdity. There's nothing manifestly absurd about a continuance. We get them all the time. Sometimes we get them for reasons that don't have anything to do with the trial itself. I came here today. I had to continue three cases that I would have had today. There's nothing absurd about that. All of us know that. And the Commonwealth, again, the Commonwealth, the court does not simply have to swallow the information given as truth. We have the opportunity to have a continuance, and we can have testimony in court after the motion has been made timely.
All right, your time has expired.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your argument. The court is adjourned.
All right.